For many years, antibiotics were considered a miracle medication. Their ability to combat infections saved an untold number of lives. While they are still an important tool in fighting infection, there is increasing evidence that antibiotics are losing their punch, that bacteria have learned how to fight back and resist the drug's ability to cure. Antibiotic resistance is blamed for thousands of deaths a year. For Stephanie and Steve Littlejohn, it meant the loss of their daughter, Meredith. She was being treated for a form of cancer when she developed a non-related antibiotic resistance infection. The medication failed. The infection killed her. Steve Littlejohn joins us in studio along with Dr. William Powderly. He's director of the Washington University Institute for Public Health and co-director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the WashU School of Medicine. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Doctor, let me begin with you. Why and how has this resistance evolved and developed?
Resistance has actually been a problem since the first days of antibiotics. When we first developed penicillin, very soon we saw a resistant infection. What has happened over the last 20 years in particular is that the pace of evolution of bacteria has outrun the pace of development of new drugs that we have to treat them. And as a consequence, we have more and more infections for which we have few options. And in some cases, we have infections for which we have no options. And that has the primary reason why it has become a major public health issue, both in the United States and across the world. There are many factors that have led to it, but the fundamental issue is the bacteria adapt much more rapidly than we can keep up.
How is this resistance passed from person to person, if you will? I mean, we're talking about a very individual thing, these microbes and bacteria.
It's a complicated issue. In some cases, it is not passed from individual to individual, but the fact that the individual is exposed repeatedly to antibiotics and the bacteria that live in the individual themselves, whether they're on their skin or in their gut, evolve to become resistant to those antibiotics. But in many cases, it is a factor of transmission, and that can occur in the community, but it particularly occurs in hospitals, because hospitals are where we congregate people who are more likely to harbor bacteria that are transmitted, that have become resistant and can be transmitted, but also they're more vulnerable because you're not in hospital for a trivial reason anymore. You're in hospital because you have a serious illness, and often that serious illness affects your ability to fight infection. Because of the illness or the therapy you're getting for that illness, your ability to resist infection is reduced.
Steve Littlejohn, is that part of your story and the sad story of your daughter?
It's a big part of our story. Stephanie and I, we spent a lot of time in the hospital for about a year with Murdy. Her nickname was Mert or Murdy. And as Steph would tell you, and I agree with her, if Murdy had not gotten acute myeloid leukemia, which is maybe 500 kids get it a year. It's a little bit more common in adults, and it requires far more aggressive chemotherapy, which compromises the immune system. So if she had not gotten AML, if the treatments had worked in the first four go-rounds and after remission, it stayed in remission instead of a relapse. If there were medications that didn't require compromising the immune system like chemotherapy, the ifs go on. And so the particular instance where she was in a very high-risk situation, the docs and the nurses were just doing everything they could possibly do. We felt like the whole hospital was marshaled for MERT. When the immune system is not there to help the drugs, and you can't rely on the newer drugs. You have to go back to the drugs that are toxic, really. It increases the risk.
I can't imagine what you and your wife would be going through during a process like this, where you know there are drugs out there that theoretically should be able to deal with situations like this, but in your particular case, just couldn't.
You know, there was so much going on with leukemia, with bone marrow transplant, with watching for other – we were generally concerned about infection anyway. And any number of times the blood samples would be taken from the various IVs and the like, and you'd wait. You'd wait until you saw whether they became – positive or not. And I can recall we'd hit the 24-hour mark and go, on that day, for that moment, something of a sigh of relief. And so that waiting process, and I imagine Dr. Powderly can talk about the whole detection issue, because right now you don't know what it is or if you have it, oftentimes not for 24 hours. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty critical 24 hours when, if it gets in your bloodstream, you're at risk of septic shock, and that's really hard.
Yeah, we hear time and time again the doctor has alluded to that this happens far too often in our hospitals. How frustrating, doctor, that has to be for you and yours and your profession.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the challenges we have as an infectious disease doctor is that it can be hard to diagnose an infection, but it's even more frustrating when you diagnose the infection and your options are limited. Steve and I were talking earlier about the fact that much of modern medicine has been successful because we've managed to control infection. You can't do modern surgery if you don't control infection. You can't do organ transplantation. Chemotherapy for cancer. The major risk of all of these procedures, all of these advances, is infection. And the threat we have, if we start to see infection, bacterial infection that we actually can't treat, is that these advances will stop and we'll go back to where we were 50, 70 years ago. And that's why we target this as a public health issue. That it's not just for the individual at the moment sitting at Barnes Hospital or any hospital across the country, but it's actually something that all of us need to be thinking about, because at some point either one of us or a member of our family may need these remarkable advances in medicine and have them unavailable because of the infection risk.
But there's not really anything that we can as individuals do, or is there?
Well, I would say there is, and I'm sure Stephen has his perspective. But I will put that this is a multifaceted problem, and it requires therefore everybody to think about it and participate in its solutions. Antimicrobial resistance starts actually because we overuse antibiotics in general. We use them for feeding animals, and we misuse them in animal husbandry and in our food industry. And that means that environmentally we have more resistant bacteria out there. We treat far too many people who don't have an infection with an antibiotic. And that's actually something where the public an informed public can do something, because many of the times people go to their doctor with a cold, with a virus infection, and expect an antibiotic. And if they don't expect that antibiotic, or ask the doctor, why do I really need an antibiotic, then maybe the antibiotic won't be used. And then we have then a situation that we need to be vigorous about preventing infections in our hospitals, but we also need technology. And this is where, as the public, the importance of investing in research. we need new drugs and we need better ways of diagnosing infection early. And that armamentarium, from where it starts so you can prevent it to the end point where there's an opportunity for the public to be involved in multiple steps along that road.
Steve, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I'll weigh in with something very simple but incredibly important that any family member, any caregiver, anyone accompanying someone into the hospital can tackle, really. And that's washing hands. Mm-hmm. That's using the disinfectant canisters. They were all over the place, sure. And we'd go anywhere and just constantly doing that. And it also is, if you're in the in your family member's or a friend's hospital room, and you'll quickly see the constant circulation of medical staff all working hard, all doing what they need to do, but they're circulating from one patient to the next patient to the next patient. And people are human, and sometimes they forget to wash their hands after seeing a patient and then to wash them again before going into seeing a new patient. And so you can designate someone as your hand-washing guard, if you will, and never, never, never hesitate to ask members of the medical team, did you wash your hands?
Go ahead.
And, did you wash your hands? And you ask them. And those that know the importance of it will say, thank you, or they'll say, yes, I did. But don't give up that. That's one thing you can really, really do.
Doctor, why the hands? Why not wear a mask? I mean, can it be transmitted other ways as well?
So most of the bacteria that we worry about are transmitted through the skin. Most of the resistant infections that we have the greatest concern about are not transmitted casually casually in the sense of being in the same room. It requires contact. So that's why I want to fully agree with Steve. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with anybody in the hospital who cares about a patient in the bed saying to the staff, please wash your hands. Mm. We reinforce that all the time, and it needs to be the norm, and accepting that as the norm. In some cases, we have to go further. We have to put people on isolation precautions because sometimes it's more than just the hands. It may be on the skin. It may be other surfaces. But it's very rarely in the air. And so we try to support families so they don't get too scared about this. If they do have somebody at risk, that you don't have to be completely cocooned.
I want to backtrack just a little bit to something you had said a couple of moments ago about things we can do as individuals. What about the doctors? I mean, the doctors are the way I come in and demand an antibiotic, and the doc says, sure, here it is. What kind of work is being done to, if you don't mind my saying so, educate the medical profession about this?
It's a great question. It's a really important issue. One of the things that we focus on is something we call antimicrobial stewardship. It's a fancy term for saying we need to be better as medical professionals in preserving the drugs we have by not overusing them, by not using them in the wrong circumstances, by telling our patients that this is a virus and it's going to get better, and giving you an antibiotic make you feel better and it'll get you out of my office quicker, but it actually won't do anything for you or for the environment.
Antibiotics are a fairly traditional treatment for a lot of illnesses that children face. Mm-hmm. Getting kids started on this process early, is that a bad thing? I mean, we really have to be careful about that?
Yes, it is a bad thing. I mean, we see bacterial resistance in the common infections that children get, which means we end up having to use stronger and stronger antibiotics when they get serious infections.
Yeah.
This goes to an issue that I mentioned earlier too is we do need better tests. Many doctors, particularly pediatricians, will know that 90% of sore throats are caused by viruses that won't respond to antibiotics, but 10% of them may be caused by serious bacterial infections that need an antibiotic. If we have better ways of distinguishing between the 90% that don't need and the 10% that do, then we won't overuse antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the pressure is on the pediatrician because mom and dad are saying, give him to me. I want this.
I want Johnny to get better quickly. I don't want him to get sick. Of course, many of us have been in that situation.
Steve, you're nodding there. Is there something you wanted to
know, the paradox here is that on an individual basis, the kid or the patient can say, with that 10% chance that it might be kind of bad, and I've seen these horrific stories, you know, about kids going swimming and coming out and getting these infections and everything. I want that antibiotic for my kid. And you might say, well, won't they be at a greater risk if they have it? Well, actually, and I'll have to defer to Dr. Mm-hmm. Powderly on this, the benefit of holding back is a common benefit. The immediate benefit of going ahead and giving it is an individual in the eyes of the individual. So you might help that individual stop that 10% chance, and they won't be any worse off. And even if they didn't have the 10% chance, if they were at a virus, it may not be any worse off as an individual. But our overall common environment will be that much less able to fend off. There'll be somebody else, somewhere else, who will pay the price.
Doctors, are there any people who are more susceptible to infection, if you will, than others? Boys, girls, young, old, black, white?
In those general terms, in terms of race or gender, no. The very young are more susceptible to infections because the very young haven't yet developed their immune system.
They don't often wash their hands, by the way.
That's very true. And as we get older, our immune system wanes a little bit, and so the elderly are also more vulnerable to infections. That's infections in general. I think Steve made a really important point, and that is that antibiotics are still wonderful drugs. If you look back mm-hmm. through the history of mankind, infections were what killed people.
Sure.
They killed women in childbirth. We don't see that anymore. Millions of children never survived the first 5 years of their life. We don't see that anymore. These are wonderful drugs. What we're really talking about is preserving them,
so that they remain effective. What's going on out there now in terms of developing new drugs? You said earlier that that's something we probably have to look at very carefully.
Well, one of the things I'm currently president of the Infectious Disease Society of America, which is the professional society for doctors who specialize in infectious diseases. And we believe this is one of the highest priorities. And one of the things that we're working on with allies, patient allies and others, is to try and create more incentives for drug companies to develop new drugs. From a drug company, it's much more profitable to develop a drug for diabetes or for cholesterol because somebody has to take it every day of the rest of their life.
Yeah.
For an antibiotic, you want it only for a short period of time. So we're working to create more incentives to have this drug companies get back into the market. We're also working to have more research be done through the NIH and through the CDC to allow new possibilities for antibiotics to be discovered.
What form might those incentives take?
Well, the biggest way is either additional tax credits for the development process, which is very expensive, or potentially additional patent protection after the drug is developed so that the drug can have a longer period of profitability for the manufacturer or the developer. Mm. But these are where where you what you want to do is create the right incentives for the drug for drugs to be developed, but also the right market force so that they will be used properly.
And you alluded to government contributing to this somehow. Are we in the right environment now for that, do you think?
Well, one of the things we have found, and I'm sure Steve can comment as well, is that this is a bipartisan issue. Infection is not discriminatory. Infection doesn't decide I'm going to infect only Democrats or only Republicans. Mm. And so most – when you talk to legislators on issues such as this, you find that the reception is positive across the board. And it's finding, therefore, a bipartisan solution that they can agree on. That is our challenge.
Well, that's comforting coming from the president of a national organization, I'm sure, has looked into this. Steve, did you want to comment on that part of it? We have about a minute left.
Well, you know, if you've got a minute left, I think the doctor did a great job in describing the politics and all that sort of thing. But I'd love to end talking about Murdy. You know, if she were here with us, she'd be sitting here because she would take up a cause. And because of her experience, she would want to pay back. And so that's why I'm sitting here in her place, really, because she was an organizer and she was great. And Steph would have loved to have been here, but it's really hard. It's really hard to talk about these things. But she writes eloquently on Facebook about our Murdy and, well – I'm just sitting here remembering her.
Well, I'm glad you are here, and it's important to get this this word out to the public. No question about it. Thank you very much, Steve Littlejohn. Your loss is something we all feel. Sorry, so sorry for you and your wife. Dr. Powderly, thank you for being with us.
Sure.
Thank you. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.